Okay, thanks very much indeed. And thanks for the reading, Lorna. I really really appreciated that. Thank you. Looking at our second in our series on Ruth. Helps to turn it on. Last week, we had the chaos of the judges. We were thinking about the setting of the book of Ruth, and we recognized the violence and the many terrible things that were going on in the land at that time. And yet, the writer is telling us the start of a new story, a story that will eventually lead to security under King David and wealth under his son Solomon. But that's still a long way away when we start our story in Ruth. And again, the book I've recommended is the Teach the Text series, Kenneth Way on Ruth and Judges and Ruth. And I've enjoyed that a lot as I've been putting some time in thinking about this series. And we left with a couple of sort of messages from last week that with God, relationship comes first. Naomi and Ruth, they bond because Ruth makes the statement that she's going to stick with Naomi whatever. And she makes a statement not just to be with Naomi, but to Naomi's God. Your God, she says, will be my God. Where you go, I will go. Where you die, I will die. And there I will be buried. And on the back of that statement that establishes a relationship, we see that things start to turn around for both Naomi and for Ruth. And we also recognize that whatever situation we're in, we do have choices that we can make. We may not like the choices we've got. We may not have as many or as wide a scope of choice as we want, but we do have choices. And one of the stories, the messages that comes out of Ruth is to recognize those choices and to make them well and to make them in a godly way. And what's ironic about our choices is very often the choices that we make that matter most are made when we're under most pressure and we're not aware of making a momentous choice at all. We're just getting on with life in front of us. And the question that we left ourselves with at the end was, how does this belief work out in the rough and tumble of a new day? Aha, that's interesting. I've just lost my mirror screen. So we've lost all of them. Okay. Right. So, we're going to, okay, I didn't know whether it was Matt or Tom. I know that there's two of them, and I don't know which is which, so now I know it's Matt. Thank you. Sorry about that. So, anyway, last week we were looking at life in the margins. That was the theme for our first week. This week we're looking at security, and next week we're going to be looking at the question about how God works for us. And as we look at Ruth, one of the turning points, the hinges in the book, is the place where she meets Boaz for the first time, and he blesses her and he says, may you find peace under the wings of the God under whose wings you have come to take refuge. And it's a beautiful phrase, isn't it? He says, may you be blessed. May God repay you for what you've done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. And it's a beautiful picture of security, that God spreads his wings over us and grants us security. And he says, you've come into this land where God will spread his wings over you. And you've come to take refuge. And the theme is very strongly one of finding security at a time of in a time when you need refuge, a time of danger. The start of chapter 3, which Lorna read to us in the middle of the reading, because we're trying to read four chapters across 3 weeks. So one day, that's where chapter 3 begins, Ruth's mother-in-law, Naomi, said to her, my daughter, I must find a home for you where you will be well provided for. And that word home is a word that we wouldn't recognize perhaps because we read the stories in English, but it relates to two stories that we know quite well. One of them is the story of Noah and the ark, and you remember he lets a dove out And the first time it comes back to the ark, it doesn't find, and what the what the passage says is it doesn't find a resting place. In the NIV that we've got, it says it doesn't find a place to perch. It doesn't find anywhere where it can rest. And so it comes back to the ark. And it's that word that Naomi has used for Ruth. She says, I want to find a place where you can rest, where you can be secure, where you can find a home. The other place that it occurs is in 1 Chronicles, where it's talking about David's life. And in the stories about David's life, perhaps the big story of David's life in the books of Samuel, particularly 1 Samuel, is that he makes the land secure, the land as a whole secure. But the story, if you read in Chronicles, is much more focused on David's big idea being to find a place where God will be worshipped, to prepare for the temple, to find, and it's that word again, a resting place for the Ark of God, a place where the Ark of God can be secure in the land. And so we have that word for security. And so Naomi says to Ruth, she said, I need to do something to find you a home, a resting place, a place of security. And that's what God wants for each of us, that we have a place where we can feel secure. Now, it's quite interesting because Ruth doesn't actually have a lot to give. It's not as though Ruth is in a position where she can leverage lots and lots of stuff. All she can do is talk. She can talk to some other people. And I was thinking that Naomi's role in this is quite an interesting one because she's a sort of a mentor. She encourages Ruth to do things that Ruth wouldn't necessarily have done on her own. And of course, that's a great power. If you're a good coach, you can coach people to do things that they couldn't do otherwise. You can, if you're a great coach, coach people to do things that you couldn't do. Bill Belichick with the New England Patriots is getting them to do all kinds of things that he, as a man of 70, could never possibly do, beating up the opposition left, right, and center. People who are good coaches can just do it by talking. And, of course, that's a very dangerous position to be in. As Danny reminds me, Terry, sometimes people take your advice. And, of course, that can be a really dangerous thing for people to be doing. But it's also, at times, a really good thing for Christians to do. And sometimes it can bring people to a place of security. I was just getting out of my car, just going to my music lesson on Friday morning, and I got out of my car and I saw that a woman was waiting for me to close the door. And so when I closed the door, as I walked past, I said, thanks ever so. And she says, it's not you, darling, it's that other car. And when I looked, she was trying to go through an archway, and there was a rather carelessly parked van. And I thought, well, you can get through that, can't you? But I realized that I wouldn't have driven forward through it. I'd have backed through it because you can see with your mirrors whether you're going to get through or not. But I wouldn't have gone through forward. And so I stood in front of her and I said, look, you can get through this. And I didn't do anything but talk to her. And I didn't really have to talk very much. I just had to say occasionally straighten up and you're doing well, it's going well, and say lots of soothing and encouraging things. And she managed to get her car through to a place where she could park it and go on to work for the day. Sometimes people like Naomi play an important role, and sometimes it can be an important role for you in helping to encourage or to bring somebody else on in their faith and the way in which they understand their walk with God. So Ruth's obvious insecurities, as we look at her life from our perspective, is that she's pretty poor, she doesn't have very much, and her social standing as an outsider is particularly weak. She's a foreigner. She's a different sort of person. She's probably a slightly different color, although they're all Semitic peoples living along that crescent there. But nonetheless, she's very noticeably somebody from somewhere else. And I thought, well, what would we try and do? How would it work in our day and age? And what we would try and do is we'd say, well, we'll create some money. We'll channel some money. We'll make some benefits, and we'll feed some benefits your ways. And then we'll try and create some rights for you that counter your marginalized existence. That's the way that our society tries to work with communities that are at the margins. And I guess when I came to do some of the early preparation, I thought there was going to be a sort of a tension between rights and relationships in looking at Ruth. And as it turns out, there is, but it's not the one I was expecting. Because the thing is that Ruth has some rights. It's not that she's totally without rights. She's a stranger. She's at the bottom of the pile, but she does have certain rights. She has the right to glean. She has the right to go through anybody's field. Anybody in that land had the right to go to somebody else's field, and they could pick their apples. They could gather their wheat at harvest time. That was the right that anybody had. And she has that right to glean. And when she threshes out this morning, the big basket full, that was about 23 liters worth of grain that she has gathered and then threshed and put into the basket. And that's quite a lot of grain that she's gotten for herself and her mother-in-law to keep them alive through the coming year. Now, as it turns out, she's also got some rights to the land. She probably doesn't realize it at the time. And I'm not clear that I fully understand what's going on here. But we can pick out the bare bones from other places in Scripture. And I'm afraid that we're going to have to do some really sort of tough stuff just for a few minutes in this morning's talk if we're going to make sense of what's going on actually in most of the rest of the Bible. There are two really important concepts that come out here. And one of them is the relationship between rights, the things you have to do, and relationship, the things you want to do. And earlier on this week, I was having lunch with a guy, and I'd looked on his LinkedIn page, and I'd seen that he's done some work with a Jewish charity. And so while I was talking to him, I said, I see that you've done this work. I said, are you Jewish? And he said, yeah, I am. And I said, what sort of Jew are you? Because my daughter-in-law had lent me a book on Judaism, and I realized that Judaism has changed an awful lot since the time of Jesus. And I've got sort of reasonable ideas about how Judaism works, but I realized that I was a bit out of date. So I thought, well, I'm chatting to this guy. I'll find out a little bit about what modern Judaism is about. And he said, yeah, I'm an Orthodox Jew. He said, I was a Reformed Jew. He said, but my wife has converted me to, she's drawn me in to a more Orthodox way of living. And I told him a bit about things I was up to that really interested me. I'm reading a new translation on the Psalms, which I'm really enjoying. And also, I said, I'm doing some stuff on Ruth. And he said, well, have you read Jonathan Sachs, the ex-chief rabbi? And I said, I haven't read him on Ruth, but I went home and Googled it. And one of the very short piece of writing that he's done on Ruth, but one of the things he explains is that there's a concept of love of something called chesed, I think if you're a Hebrew scholar, this love that God has, it's translated often in some of our translations as God's loving kindness. It's a sort of a committed love, and it's a love that is, it's not a particularly romantic, it's a love that loves, but does so in a very committed way. It just goes on and on loving. And he said, actually, we have in the name Ruth, we have an allusion to that kind of love. He said, we don't use the word Ruth in a positive way. He said, but we do know what it means to not have any Ruth. The word ruthless comes from the same root. That's somebody who doesn't care. Somebody who is completely without emotion for other people. Somebody who is simply committed. They're not committed by loyalty. They're not committed by emotion. They're not committed by anything. They will do what they want to do ruthlessly. And he said, it's the sort of the opposite of ruthless that God's love for us is. And in ways that we're going to see, and there's a couple of ways in which that comes out, we're going to see that it's that love of God that is very much on display in the book of Ruth. And particularly Naomi and Ruth are bound together by this committed love to one another. It's not a romantic love. Okay, the romance has long died. The husband has died. That's not been, whether that was there or not in the first place, I have no idea. But it's not there anymore. The thing that holds them together is not at all a romantic love. But it is a love that makes the commitment, and it's a love that sticks with the other person. It's a love that Boaz comes into eventually too. And the relationship that Ruth has with Naomi also opens up to other relationships. As we thought, it opens up her relationship with God. It's the God of Israel under whose wings she has come to take refuge. Whether she realized it when she married her Israelite husband or not, I don't know. But it's something that brings her into a relationship with God, and it creates a family, which, however vestigially, she is part of that family. And so when Ruth says to Naomi, "Don't urge me to leave you. Where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay." When she says those things, it's on the back of already having married Mahlon. In many ways, the relationships, the rights that she now enjoys, they were forged when she married Mahlon all that time ago. Like I said, you don't always know the full repercussions of the relation of the decisions that you make. So she marries Mahlon, and suddenly she has some rights. Now, this is the other hard bit that we've got to do. We've got to think a little bit about an economy that is based entirely on land. The Old Testament economy in Israel was based on land that was handed from father to son. So as an outsider, it was hard to get into that chain of passing on. And as a woman, you wouldn't share in that particularly directly anyway. But that's the way the system worked. And everything was about the amount of land that you had and the livestock that you could graze on that land. Everybody's wealth was accounted for in terms of land. Now, although we tend to own more houses in this country than they do in other countries, Germany, for instance, most people rent their house, we're still not a society that's based on land in quite that way. And in fact, in our society, you could be extremely wealthy and not own anything. If any of you have watched the film Brewster's Millions, it's a story about somebody who has to spend $30 million in 30 days without destroying anything of property. And so he ends up renting all of these suits. He goes out and he rents everything. And he's got to get through $30 million in order to inherit a fortune of $300 million. And it's a really interesting, it's a funny story, but it's also interesting that in our society, you could be phenomenally wealthy and not own anything. I don't own the car I drive. That's true for a lot of people these days. There are lots of ways in which we can have things that we don't own. And we could actually be one of the wealthiest people in the world, and we could rent everything. And there are some places that really believe in that kind of existence. But that's not the world that Ruth has come into. Ruth's come into a land that is owned by, that where land ownership really matters. And so God made certain provisions for people. So if you married somebody and your husband died, but you hadn't had any kids, his next brother in line was supposed to marry you, and the first child would take his inheritance, the father's inheritance, the dead father's inheritance, so that the line would be propagated, so that that part of the tribe wouldn't die out because the dad had died. And it's called levirate marriage. And so when it's used in a very, very complicated example in the New Testament, where the Sadducees come and ask Jesus a question. But it's also what's happening here. It's what's at the back of this story is that because Mahlon has died and Mahlon's father is dead and Chilion, Mahlon's brother, is dead, the next nearest kinsman has got the right to redeem things and to bring a child into the world for the dead man's in the dead man's name. And that person is called the kinsman redeemer. Now, I don't know, looking around your family, whether you think that kind of levirate marriage is a good idea or not, okay? You might think it's great, you might think it's disastrous, I don't know. But that was the rules of the society in which Naomi was born and into which Ruth comes. Excuse me. And she... And that's why this kinsman redeemer is such an important person, because not everybody has the right to sort out her problems. There's a limited number of people, and he has the rights. Paul picks the story up, and there's not time to do it this morning, but I can just read you a verse that shows how he makes the connection. The person who does these things, the law is not based on faith. On the contrary, it says, the person who does these things will live by them. Christ redeemed us, that's the word, from the curse of the law by becoming a curse for us, for it's written, cursed is everyone who's hung on a pole. He redeemed us in order that the blessing given to Abraham might come to the Gentiles through Christ Jesus. Very, very briefly, we'll come to this more, I suppose, at Christmas time, when we start to think, why does God have to become a man? And the answer is, it has to happen because there needs to be a kinsman redeemer. There needs to be somebody, not just who's in our family or related to us by blood. There's got to be some way that God can rescue us by being one of us. And so Jesus comes and becomes that kinsman redeemer. And that's what the New Testament readers are looking back to, and that's what probably Boaz explains to us by embedding his life in a real story. He shows us what a kinsman redemer does. And so that's the person who has the right. After all these men have died, he has the ability to do things. And Ruth has rights to the land through Naomi's rights to the land. If you go back and read in Deuteronomy, you can actually read the transaction that took place. And next week, maybe we can get time to read that. Next week, we'll take a look and see that the story actually follows quite closely the narrative in Deuteronomy. So what's been happening? Well, first of all, the clock's ticking. They're going to starve if nothing happens. And Naomi's been doing some thinking, and she realizes that she has to do stuff. We've seen that Ruth has been out there in the fields and has accidentally stumbled upon the field of a kinsman redeemer. Then Naomi uses her sort of coaching, her mentoring, and she advises Ruth on what to do. Now, what Ruth does, it's not clear whether it was it's a really sort of salacious story of what happens on the threshing floor, or whether the innuendo is completely without warrant, and she simply lies there and makes herself known to Boaz. But there are certain words there that are used in the Hebrews that could be understood as being euphemistic in terms of Ruth's encounter with Boaz. My guess is that it wasn't a particularly salacious encounter, but I think that it was certainly on the edge of things, because Boaz doesn't want anybody to see that a woman has been on the threshing floor that night. But anyway, Ruth does probably what she would never have dreamed of doing. She has the courage to go and do it. She has the motivation, and she does it, and off she goes. But it's quite clear that Boaz has also been doing some thinking. It's not just that Boaz has seen that there's this woman that's turned up and has been looking after her mother-in-law and has been gleaning in his fields. He's also sorted out who her nearest kinsman redeemer is. And he knows that he's number two in the line. He knows that there is somebody else in there. And he only knows that because he must have been doing some homework himself. Now, next week, when we come to the story, and it's hard to know how to do this story over several weeks, because you do want to jump ahead every now and again, but I don't think it'll be a spoiler alert to say that the closer relative wants the land, but he doesn't want Ruth. The closer relative wants he'd like to expand his territory, but he doesn't want Ruth. And he's worried about what Ruth will do to his bloodline. And the real irony, of course, is that the longest bloodline that we have in the whole of the Bible has got Ruth in it, and she's mentioned in it, and he isn't mentioned in it. So whatever it did to the bloodline, it was the bloodline that we've got has got Ruth there starring in it. And he's willing to buy the land from Naomi. He's willing to pay for that. And that would certainly get them out of short-term poverty, but not, of course, any long-term solution. And we can see that something that was talked about in Deuteronomy about a brother taking on his brother's widow has been enacted. So, I think the first thing is that God really does want us to have security. The key findings are that God wants us to be secure in our lives with him. I think that there are things that are going on here. God is certainly working, but it's not in a very clear way. There's sort of unusual things going on. And it looks to me like Naomi and Boaz sort of busk it a little bit. They sort of make up the rules a little bit around the theme that was written down, but it seems to me that they sort of push ahead on their own. The love of God, that deep love, that stretching love that goes on forever and ever, that is illustrated probably in Ruth in a way that we don't see it illustrated in any other book of the Bible. That committed love, and it's that love that takes us through and turns our lives around. So I hope that as we think about the questions of security, as we think about the kinsman redeemer, as we think about that love that God has for us, and as we work out that God actually wants us to enjoy and to see him working in our lives to bring us to a position of security where we can work out our worship in security, I hope that we will look forward to next week. And if you're reading ahead, there's probably four things that are worth looking for. Number one is, first of all, think about the coincidences. There are several coincidences mentioned in Ruth. Why are those coincidences there? What's going on? Secondly, there are commitments that people make to other people. And how is God working through those commitments? How does God work when people don't live up to their commitments, when they say, no, I don't want to do that? How does God work there? And then what are the things that God expects us to do if we're going to see him work? And what are the things that we have to expect God to do if God's going to work in our lives? So I hope next week that we can bring things to a bit of a conclusion there. Thanks very much indeed.